carry ourselves with us no matter how far or fast we run. We can leave home. We can change our names or hide inside of them. We can grow our hair long and hide behind that. We can reinvent everything. But we can never fully outrun where we come from. Not really. Just ask Arturo O'Farrell. He tried for a while. But in the end, it turns out he wasn't running away. He was running home. It's just that home was not found in any one particular place. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Arturo O'Farrell was 19 years old, by his own description, a long-haired, stoned-out, freaky kid playing piano for beers in a bar in upstate New York, when jazz icon Carla Bley walked in. She saw something in him, and heard something, too, and it wasn't just talent, it was spirit, so she invited him to join her band. At the time, Arturo wanted nothing to do with his family's legacy. His father, Chico O'Farrell, was one of the architects of Afro-Cuban jazz, what some call cubop. His mother was a singer from Mexico, and Arturo was born in Mexico before moving to New York as a boy. Cuban, Mexican, with the last name O'Farrell, which was both notable and noticeable for how un-Latin it sounded, he was confused. And meanwhile, he was doing everything he could to avoid what he thought of as the Latin thing. He was searching for his own voice. But Carla Bley, in her typically idiosyncratic way, didn't try to shape him into anything. She fostered his wildness. She gave him permission to be the outlier he already was. He says, "She recognized the craziness in me, and she encouraged it." Arturo would then go on to work with the likes of Dizzy Gillespie, Steve Turay, Lester Bowie, and eventually Harry Belafonte, serving as his music director in the late 80s. All the while, he was sidestepping the shadow of his father's music. But that began to change when the bassist Andy Gonzalez sat Arturo down in his Bronx apartment and played him the history of the music that he had avoided. That conversation unlocked something. O'Farrell began to understand that this Latin thing, the music of the African diaspora, wasn't a cage. It was a treasure that held complexity, nuance, and profound power. So he reconnected musically with his father. He took over the Chico O'Farrell Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra, and then he founded the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra, first under the umbrella of Jazz at Lincoln Center, before forging its own independent path. And he began to expand his idea of what Afro-Latin music could include. He built a body of work grounded not just in groove or virtuosity, but in meaning. His music started to carry a message. Because for Arturo, music isn't just sound. It's a mode of transportation, a way to move ideas, to carry truth, to stir justice. As he told me, "You can pretend that music is pretty noise or think that it's just meant to soothe, but I don't believe that's the purpose of art." That philosophy lives in everything he does, from his records like The Offense of the Drum, Fandango at the Wall, Mundo Agua, his latest suite about the climate crisis, or Four Questions featuring Cornel West.
"But in the face of 400 years of terrorism, 400 years of stigmatism, 400 years of trauma, we didn't produce a black Ku Klux Klan, a black ISIS. We produced Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells, Barnett, Harriet Tubman, and W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Fannie Lou Hamer. What is it about these people, in the face of so much hatred, dishing out such love, in the face of so much injustice, teaching the world so much about justice?"
That philosophy is also very alive at Casa Bilongo, the cultural center he's building in Harlem. It's a community hub with performance spaces, classrooms, and rehearsal rooms. Not just a building, but a structure of belief. Sometimes a conversation doesn't just explore a person's life, it opens a window into their soul, and that is how this one felt to me. We talked about legacy and identity, about teaching and faith, imposter syndrome and social change, about what it means to be fully yourself, even when it's complicated. Especially when it's complicated. For more conversations like this one, head to third-story.com, where you'll find an extensive archive of deep dives with other bridge builders, outliers, and musical truth tellers, including composer Maria Schneider or Arturo's own son, Adam O'Farrell. And you can find me on Substack. It's leosidran.substack.com for new episodes, essays, updates, and occasional rabbit holes. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more great content. Here's me and Arturo O'Farrell talking it down. Part of the reason I knew it would be okay to ask you to come here is because I know that you have a history in this neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
Your son, Adam, actually sat in this very same chair a couple of years ago.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And we talked, and he told me about his relationship with the neighborhood. Yeah. And like Amanda, my wife, just said to you, we go every Christmas Eve to see you right around the corner.
That's right. That was my church. It still is. It'll always be my church. I go somewhere else now because we kind of bought a little house upstate.
Uh-huh.
And so we've been spending time there, and I have a lot of commissions and a lot of composing to do, and so I really need quiet. So we bought a little place up in Putnam Valley and kind of starting to spend more time there.
Tell me about that needing quiet to write.
I think writing, composing is a little bit like punching yourself in the face repeatedly. This is really literally my experience. Everything I write, I go, oh, it sucks. You're terrible. You're such a fraud. You're such a phony. It just, you're, that's it. No, I don't know why anybody listens to you. But the part that's punching you in the face, punching yourself in the face, is not that you think those things, but then you have to commit to those ideas. Otherwise, you'll never move forward.
Yes.
I mean, you'll never get past that first. If you convince yourself it sucks and you don't do it because you're editing, then you're never going to turn out anything out. And I can't do that. I have way too much, way too many deadlines.
When deadlines are maybe the only way to get past that sometimes is just to force, you know, you got to deliver something.
Yeah. Well, deadlines have the magic ability to make you get past your ego.
Yeah.
And deadlines have the ability to make you get past your inflated sense of self.
Do you find over time with more validation, recognition, experience?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't get any better.
No, absolutely not. I just wrote a piece this week for our concert in Carnegie Hall, and I'm sure it's the worst thing that I've ever done. And it's probably going to fall flat on its face, and people are going to walk out of Carnegie Hall going, what a fraud. Mm. I want my money back. I'm not completely convinced of that, but that's how I feel about it.
Right. That's the feeling that you have about it. But once it goes over one time, are you a little bit reassured?
I periodically will listen to stuff I've written years later and think, that's not so bad.
Yeah. But then again, that can also reinforce. I mean, this is what I go through in my own little work. Like when I hear work that I did years ago and I think it's good, that only reinforces my fear that I lost it. You know, that I had something that peaked when I was younger.
No, there's that too. I kind of feel like it's a construct.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like we do it to ourselves to keep ourselves guessing. Because if I ever figure out what I'm doing, just kill me. Mm. I love the idea of not understanding what I do. I love the idea of this being kind of an infinite playground that I do not understand. I don't want to understand it. I don't want to be a spokesperson. I just want to struggle with defining the things that I do every time I do them. Because if I ever think, literally, this is true with my piano playing as well. Literally, if I ever think I've arrived, I'll go quietly into the night.
I mean, maybe the last breath you take can be the one where you think, okay, I did it.
I have this stupid fantasy where I get up every day at the same time, go for a walk, make a nice breakfast, maybe go swimming, then maybe come back and watch some TV, then have lunch, then maybe go out and do some, I don't know, sheep wrangling.
Yeah.
I have this fantasy.
This is retirement.
Right, I have this fantasy that at some point in my life I'll just, it's not true. I
not
know it's
happen.
Completely knuckleheaded.
As you talk about the sort of imposter syndrome, which I really have come to feel that anybody who doesn't suffer from it is not to be trusted, because some of the people who I admire enormously, yourself included, confess to feeling that same way, so, which leads me to believe there's something important about feeling that way.
I think that we construct a lot of realities. It's a way of dealing with the vicissitudes of day-to-day life. And I think the imposter syndrome is not only something I really feel, but something that's very comfortable.
Mm.
It's something that I've constructed to make me want to be better. And I don't really not care about what people think, but I also really know that the true voice of an Arturo or any artist is not always palatable, certainly not always commercial.
Yeah.
And if you want to change conversations, you have to go with that muse, even if you think you're, you know, stepping onto a frozen lake that's not quite solid.
I mean, this gives us an opportunity to talk about both something that happened to you early in your career and that you're revisiting now, which is your relationship with Carla Bley. Because in your most recent record, Mundagua that you dedicate to Carla, and you also recorded her, apparently her last commissioned piece, her last piece that she wrote.
I commissioned her very last work, which is really fitting because I feel like Carla, I was playing for beers in a bar in Willow, New York when Carla, quote unquote, discovered me. But I think more than discovered me, I think she took a hell of a chance on this long-haired, stoned-out, freaky kid.
19 years old.
Yeah, I mean, I was just playing with my friends for beers. And Carla transported me to the stages of the International Jazz Festival circuit. And she, I mean, I had really literally never played for her outside of that.
So the reason I bring that up is because in your statement about her, in talking about this last record, you said she's been your North Star. And you refer to her as somebody who always followed her own muse, regardless of whether or not it was something that people were asking for, maybe were even going to want. She had to follow her own artistic vision, and that's something that you borrowed from or inspired you.
I look at careers, and I look at people's outlaying of their careers and the paths that they take that determine their aesthetic credentials. Mm. And there's so many different things that would have like plied into my ego or plied into my, and Carla was none of those things. Carla was a challenge from every angle. She loved my freakishness. She loved my craziness. Instead of trying to make me fit into a, dare I say it, a downbeat mold, she let me be completely wild and crazy and express, and she encouraged craziness in her musicians, which I thought was amazing. Because, of course, what we're taught as musicians is fit this mold and you'll experience artistic liberty. It's such a, like, you know, learn these formulas and you'll learn how to play like Albert Eiler.
Mm-hmm.
Not true. The formulas are really like almost barriers to getting creative. And I think that with Carla, I saw the fact that I could sight read and play the piano well was just one little trick, one little arsenal that helped me get that gig. But what really helped me get that gig and maintain it for years is that I was quite insane. And she saw that insanity in me that she also harbored and encouraged it. And so I spent 3 years of my formative life understanding that it's okay. It's okay to be different. It's okay to be crazy. It's okay to have a conviction and to let that conviction be the primary guiding force of life. If I had ended up with somebody else, I might have just said, oh, well, I want more acclaim, more downbeat pull awards.
Of course, you had another model that you saw early on in your father.
Of course.
And look, my father's a musician. You have children who are musicians also. And so I'm intimately aware of the dance that goes on when you're, you know, a second or third generation. But it seems like at the beginning of your career, you really needed to make an effort to make sure that you were not seen in this. And you didn't necessarily want to play that music that your father was playing or in the way that he was playing it.
I think a lot of that had to do with coming to the United States as a little Mexican boy and not seeing any Latinos in my life except the super in my building and the super in my school, and then kind of feeling othered. Mm. And I spent a lot of my years on the Upper West Side, which was decidedly not Latino, in a private school for the first part of my life, which was a completely bizarre experience. I mean, when your classmates live on Central Park West, the last thing you want to do is bring attention to the fact that you're not that socioeconomic class.
Uh-huh.
And it took me years to realize this, but everything that I associated with self-loathing came from my background.
Mm.
And I think that happens. We talk a lot about how we have Latinos for Trump.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about the idea that, listen, Latinos do this thing. They come to this country and they embrace the values and reject themselves. And that's why you have these incredibly diametrically opposed systems.
I mean,
the idea that a president that hates immigrants, hates black and brown people is your poster boy, that comes from being in, you know, wherever you're from and seeing nobody in your color be the dominant culture. So I spent a lot of time going, why am I different? Why can't? And then, I mean, on top of everything else, my father came from a series of career paths that, quite frankly, were also confusing. I mean, he was writing big band records for the greatest band of all time, Count Basie.
Yeah.
And yet he was also still the mambo person.
Yeah.
And so it was really confusing to me. And all of these things kind of led me to say, I don't want any part of this. Yeah. I recognized that I loved playing the piano. I loved music. I loved being a musician. But I sure as hell wasn't going to go down that confusing path. And then later on, I realized that I was on that path anyway.
Yeah.
Because no matter what I do, your name is still Arturo O'Farrell.
Right, makes sense of that.
Yeah. I mean, and then what do? I'm a pianist or a composer? Am I black? Am I white? Am I Latino? I'm not Latino enough, but I'm certainly not black, but I'm not white. So all these things kind of, it made it really difficult for me to float into anything, but High School of Music and Art, group of freaky, stoned out people who didn't fit anyway.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what melted into Carla Bleek.
Right, that's what Carla saw.
Carla saw it, and Carla peppered her bands, salt and peppered her bands, if you will.
Yeah.
She populated her bands with every kind of misfit you could imagine.
Yeah.
And I got to see these people up close and recognize that in all of us, there was just this outlier thing.
Yeah.
That Carla, her, and that actually the biggest outlier of them all was Carla Bleek.
Yeah.
She should have been a cigarette girl at Birdland or a singer.
Yeah.
Instead, she became this incredible composer that changed the rules for what jazz is.
Mm-hmm.
How dare she? Did she not understand that outliers are not supposed to change the world? But she didn't. It was incredible. And I mean, to this day, I get emotional when I think about the license this woman gave me, because it's huge.
Yeah.
This is the thing that defines me to this day.
I want to spend another minute just talking about this confusion that you had, that eventually you realized I'm on the path regardless of whether I want to be on the path or not, because you referred to yourself as a little Mexican boy. Your mother's Mexican. You were born in Mexico. Your father was from Cuba, but his family was Irish and German.
Irish,
German,
yeah. Yeah.
So I can imagine that you would say, I don't fit in. I'm not Mexican enough to identify as Mexican. I'm not Cuban enough to identify as Cuban. I'm not Upper West Side enough to identify as Upper West. I'm all these things and none of these things. And later on, you know, you said in your sort of opening statement, I don't want to be an advocate or a spokesperson. I just want to write this music. But you are a spokesperson for a kind of more open-minded idea of what Latin and Afro-Latin music can be today.
I don't separate Latin and Afro-Latin music from jazz or music in general. I feel like in some ways the African diaspora is the most important ingredient in everything we do, whether you're playing jazz, Latin jazz, or, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like that music isn't the music of, yes, and Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yeah.
And when you take the quote-unquote whitest prog rock, and if you're not careful, you will discover the African diaspora.
Sure.
So for me, I feel like the spokesperson I am, I'm very proud, by the way, now. This is the thing that happened. I remember writing about this first speech. I was giving a speech at the International Association of Jazz Educators.
Yeah.
And the speech began with, I don't fit in. I didn't win the monk. I didn't come from this world. I didn't come from that world. And it used to cause me so much consternation. But what I realized it first caused me so much pain was my greatest strength. And so in a way, this thing, this not fitting neatly, actually, in fact, it's interesting you mentioned Chico, because Chico did not fit neatly into anything. That's why he wrote, you know, 10 albums for Count Basie, a bunch of albums for Machito, and Ringo Starr. Then he wrote arrangements for a Ringo Starr album and a David Bowie album. So, I mean, he was that like craftsperson that was bigger than his socioeconomic or cultural ethical heritage. And I use the word ethical, by the way, very pointedly.
Tell me.
Well, because music is ethics.
Music is a form of transportation for you. It is not the end all be all. It's the way to get to something else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that when I say ethics in music, I think the correct moral and ethical response to music is to embrace it all.
Yeah.
To see the transmigratory currents that have brought the guitar to our shores or the trumpet to whatever it is. If you're going to pretend that you belong in this camp or that camp and that's the only way you can listen to music, you are being unethical.
Well, why do you think that happens? I mean, is it based on commercial considerations. It also happened in education where people are in various camps in terms of what they do.
I think it's humanity. Yeah. I wish I could blame it on American exceptionalism whatever racial, ethnic. I think it's human nature. Human nature wants to codify and organize and claim whatever clothing, cheese, music thing. This is mine because it's of my tribe. And I think nothing could be more contrary to progression. Yeah. Nothing could be more contrary to growth, personal growth, emotional growth, spiritual growth, cultural growth, societal growth. Yeah. If we don't look, and this is, of course, this is now, we are in it. We are in that incredibly frightening land of absolute police state. The people that are running the game now are rabid anti-humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are racists, they are sexist, they are homophobes, they are everything that you can imagine. And then people want to go, well, that's an American thing. No, no, it's not. It's a human thing. Human beings have a predilection for owning, controlling, and defining.
We contain multitudes and we are capable of leaning in either direction. I've often thought, well, no, we are not by nature bad or good. We are kind of taught to be one or the other. But I've learned in the last decade of my own life, looking at what's going on in this country.
If you look at an infant crying to have its needs met, you could conceivably call that selfish, egotistical, but that's a difference. And for me, and that was funny that you said this, because this morning I was thinking about an infant and its need to be the center. Yeah. And I was trying to define for myself what's different between that and a person who thinks America first is the correct syndrome that we need to exhibit.
You talked about how is it possible so many Latino immigrants would vote for this guy who, it's not even like he's hiding it. It's trauma.
We've been traumatized. Yeah. And I have personally felt it. And that's why I'm so grateful to have made the choices I've made, which was to look at the things that alienated me from the rest of society and embrace them. Because to me, that is the definition of art. The definition of Arturo is, I don't want to play in a camp.
Yeah.
I don't want to be in a camp. I don't want to be a part of any organization that would have me as its member.
Yeah.
Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Groucho Marx is the center of all wisdom as far as I'm concerned.
Are you a big Marx Brothers fan?
Oh my God. Duck Soup.
Yeah.
Hooray for Captain Spaulding, the African explorer. Did anyone say schnorr? I mean, this is to me, wow, why would a little Mexican kid fall in love with Groucho Marx? Why did a little Mexican kid fall in love with the Guernica, Picasso's Guernica? Why did a little Mexican kid weep when they heard the strings take over the woodwind in Maurice Ravel's La Tumba of the Cooper? And why would any of this? Because all of it has nothing to do with your acculturation and everything to do with your humanity. Mm. This is why, to me, the African diaspora is so important. It means you have to let go of what you think. Jazz is not American. I hate that with a passion. Latin music is not Latino. It's all part of a cultural framework and fabric that has passed from India to the Middle East to Spain to North and West Africa. And so anytime you cast that, and I do believe, though, that all the most beautiful things that I know pass through Mother Africa, whether or not they're born of the Asian, South Asian, or whatever, wherever they're born, because of this cataclysm called the slave trade, all of it passes through Africa. Yes. I don't play Afro-Latin music. I don't write Afro-Latin music. I use the tools that I think are closest to that filter that I so cherish.
I take all of that. It gives me a sense of where your head and heart are at. But it's interesting because when you came in, I mean, I was really curious to hear the foundations of the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra. As you started to explore whatever title you want to call it, the music that you had, for whatever reason, decided that you weren't going to play that music for a while.
Hated it.
And you find yourself in New York as a professional musician. I don't know the story, you have to tell me, but you end up turning to Andy Gonzalez.
The transformative moment was when Andy convinced me, because I had such great regard for Andy.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about knowing who he was and his history. When Andy played the bass, I felt like you know, the cosmos was speaking to me. So when Andy said to me, you know, you should really, really examine your roots.
So he sees you trying to play this music and he says you should.
It wasn't even that. He had followed my career.
Uh-huh.
He knew about Carla Bley. He knew about the years with Carla. I mean, Andy was such a wide open human being that he didn't limit his taste or listening to just one thing.
Yeah.
Andy was a connoisseur.
Yeah.
And so he knew my work with Carla, which already was like already put him and me on the fringe side of reality.
Yeah.
And he's the one who said to me, he said, I'm a big fan. And I went, what?
Hmm.
He said, I'm a big fan. Yeah, but you should really examine this music that you don't play. I don't know the words he used, but that was basically the message. And then he literally sat me down in his apartment on Fort Independence Avenue in the Bronx and played me the history of this music. And as he played it for me, I began to realize that in some ways, this thing I had rejected was literally the biggest treasure of what I valued as a human being and as an aesthetic. And he literally, you know, showed me that not only is Latin music or what we call Latin music, which I now call Afro-Latin music because I think the African diaspora is by far the biggest part of it, not the Spanish side, but the music that he showed me was profound and in some ways trickier to play than bebop. Forgive me, jazz fans, but in some ways much more nuanced than anything I understood as jazz. I was already really, really good jazz player, if I do say so myself.
Yes.
I was already playing on a very high level with Carla, with Noel Pointer, with this one, with that one. All of a sudden I went, wow, I don't really understand this music. And I began to see it as something so incredibly difficult to do well. If you want an example of that, write out a Gascada pattern, a Montuno pattern, and a Martillo pattern, and hand them to three jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, this is where we ultimately get. This is what ends up happening. At some point, you get asked by Wynton Marsalis to go in and help them put together a Tito Puente tribute concert of some kind. And you discover in that process that that band, as great as they play, could not play the music the way you wanted them to play it.
Well, Wynton, to his credit, realized it wasn't convincing. And then he wrote this arrangement of a Latin piece, a tango piece, and he pulled me aside and said, why isn't it working?
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, you're not letting the rhythm section breathe, and the orchestra's not feeling that rhythm section because it hadn't grown up understanding the way that music works. So when you play a trumpet, I mean, the simple truth is Latin brass and woodwind musicians, when they play this music, they intuitively understand or at least know or even are experts in what clave inflection is. And, you know, at that point, that band, it is an incredible band. I mean, it's an amazing band. Musicians of that caliber are rare and incredibly important. But not having grown up in that music is really important. I think Carlos Enriquez has done a lot to make sure that the musicians of the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra know and understand what it means to be acculturated to that music. And I'm grateful to Carlson. I'm very, very deeply, deeply grateful to Wynton, because Wynton is, of all of the gatekeepers, Wynton's the one that said, come into my house. You're welcome. And I would not be doing what I do if it weren't for Chico Farrell, Carla Bley, and Wynton Marsalis.
So Wynton gave you a space to start your band, basically put a band together. That,
well, what he wanted me to do was create a band for Jazz Lincoln Center that played Afro-Cuban music, and what I wanted to do was expand the language. So I started
there
by doing the museum band repertory kind of stuff that they do, but then I started really kind of expanding what I was doing with that band. And the first thing I did, which I didn't think they expected, was call it Afro-Latin, not Afro-Cuban, because, you know, Cuba's one tiny, delightful slice of that Afro-Latin, African diasporic inspired music. But it's Afro-Peruvian, Afro-Colombian, Afro-Bolivian, Afro-Jamaican, Afro-Merengue. I mean, there's so many music that would fall under Latin and jazz that does not have anything to do with Cuba. And it all comes again from that same incredible source, Mother Africa instructing, filtering, lovingly reminding us that this is where the music comes from. And you hear it very clearly, because if you hear the rhythms, the acrostic rhythms of the people of Ghana, if you hear the rhythms of the Moroccan people, the Shabi rhythm, you're going to hear everything you thought you heard in a salsa record or or in the Machito record.
Yeah. And somewhere in this space, you reconnected with the music of Chico, and you ended up helping him in the last years of his life with his band.
I did.
With your father, Chico.
I never really rejected Chico's music. I was always in awe of Chico and understood that he was some sort of genius, but I didn't want to be associated with that, so I kind of siphoned him off to the side. Plus, he was my father. Listen, the best advice you can give a human being is whatever your parents tell you, reject it, put it through your own critical reasoning, and then come up with the best thing that you can come up from their understanding of life. I tell that to my kids.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I mean, both of my sons, I tell them, do not accept anything I say on blind trust. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story that I've never told. I went to Cuba before there was commercial flights, and that involved going to Miami and getting a charter flight and getting there the night before and like waiting online for 2 or 3 hours while the charter flight people put you through all kinds of rigmarole. Yeah. And at the end of an 8 or 9 hour process, you flew 20 minutes down from Key West.
Yeah.
And I had one night engagement at the Cuba Plaza Jazz Festival and literally had to do the 12-hour nonsense through Miami, go to Cuba, do the gig, and then come right back for the 12-hour. So as soon as I landed in Miami, I called Allison, my wife, and said, I'm home. Is everything okay? And she kind of went, yes. And I could hear it in her voice. I went, what? What's going on? She goes, no, everything's fine. I said, everything's fine. I said, what are you talking about? Yeah. I hear it in your voice. Yeah. What's going on? She goes, your son got a tattoo. So I said, what the? Did he put on his body?
Your body, yeah.
She said, oh, some stupid advice you gave him. So my beautiful baby boy, my son, my king, wrote on his arm, always create reality, which is some stupid stuff that I always say. I understand there's a nuance to it.
I mean, that's
but
funny,
it's still, it was just one of those moments where, yes, whatever your parents say, think it through.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with me and Chico. I understood his genius, but I really was reticent to be compared to him, which is a big thing. Which is a big thing to be in competition. It's a well-known psychological addiction disorder. It's the opposite of the Oedipal complex,
exactly.
I think. It's a father complex. Yeah. And so I did not want... I've been a composer my whole life.
Yeah.
I've been a composer since I was 7 or 8, and I never played my music with anybody because I did not want to be compared.
Did you play it for him?
I never played. I took one lesson with my father, and it was like teaching your kid to drive after three accidental brake stomps. I just said, no, this is not going to work. But it was a funny incident that got me past that moment, and that was Wynton had befriended Chico and was really gracious in extending a lot of that. He gave him a concert at Lincoln Center at the Alice Tully Hall. And by this time, I was already playing with Andy Gonzalez. Yeah. I was playing with Papo Vasquez. I was already...
And with Jerry, too?
Andy with Jerry, Andrew, too. Yeah. I did some work with Fort Apache Man, which was a huge high. It was a high point.
Yeah.
But I was beginning to do a lot of Latin work, and I was beginning to embrace and really understand the incredible majesty of this music. And Wynton invited Chico to do a concert at Alice Tully Hall, and Chico was already getting frail. He was getting quite feeble. And he introduced Wynton and said, ladies and gentlemen, one of the greatest trumpet players of all time, please help me to say hello to, and then he forgot his name. So I'm sitting at the piano going, Wynton, and Alice Tully Hall, Wynton Marsalis, the Chico Farrell Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra. It's a lovely, lovely moment. Someone yells out, we love you, Chico! And I go home, and there's a message on my answering machine from somebody who puts on a fake British accent saying, Atiru Mohundiro, let it be known you don't have a 40th of your father's talent.
Mm.
In fact, I foresee you picking through garbage. That was an incredible moment for me, because the thing that I feared more than anything in life, almost as much as fearing Chico's demise, had just happened to me. And not only did I not die, not only did my brain not explode, But I realized that in that moment, I was a completely different composer, musician than Chico. I had a completely different set of values. I didn't even think like him. There was the comparison between me and Chico was so silly that at that moment, I realized it was insane. And anybody who would be a big enough asshole to try and hurt me with that, I would never be that person. And so there was all kinds of liberation.
So somebody calls you, you have no idea who it is. To this day, you don't know
I
who it
do.
Is.
I think I do know who you it do is. Know but who it I,
doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
I just want to settle in that for a second. Your worst nightmare is that somebody's going to say, you don't live up to your father.
Yep. Or you're better than your father.
Or either way.
Either way.
And once you experience that.
It's fratricide if you think about it. In a very real way, being better than your father or being worse than your father is putting a value, a finished value on that person.
Yeah.
And he was already older. He hadn't died yet, which was something else that I feared my entire life.
That he was going to die.
And I loved my father because at the other end of the spectrum was the fact that I was a little Mexican boy kept from Chico, really. So he was mystical. He was bigger than life. I loved my father.
Why were you kept from him?
Because Latinos. The kids are seen and not heard. We had a nanny.
Yeah.
Chico did something that I didn't understand. My mother was very protective of him. My mother and father lived a life devoted to him and his career and his luminescence, which kind of actually made me love him more, I think, because I didn't have access to him in the way that most kids might. Only my father ever took us to a Little League game or to a PTA conference. Mm. None of that stuff happened in my house, which is okay.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm very pleased by it. I'm glad in a way that I didn't have a normative experience because it would have changed who I am now. But yeah, so when that happened, I mean, all kinds of just fireworks inside my life. And I started composing really in earnest and started seeking my own voice and realizing that I would never write my father and I completely. He's a brass player. So his composing is very, very different. I'm a pianist. Mm-hmm. I have to think like a brass player, in other words, to get that linear kind of landscape thinking.
That was the word I was waiting for you to say, is that as a brass player, you might write in a more linear way.
Absolutely. My father was anal enough to put fingerings in trumpet parts. There's five other composers in jazz that do that.
Wow.
But on the other hand, I'm a pianist. My composing is different in the sense that it is much more intervallic. It's much more rooted in construction of intervals, not necessarily chords, but just the relationship of intervals within a chord, within a structure. That's just something that I don't even believe in chords anymore. I mean, I use them when I have to, but
if there's a blowing section, do you give anything for people to latch on to?
Well, when I did the Afro-Latin Jazz Suite with Rudresh Mahanthapa, and I knew this because Rudresh was probably the only person in the world that would understand what I was doing. Instead of chord symbols, I gave him clusters on his part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a solo over this, and then I specifically laid out a voicing.
Yeah.
And so to me, the relationship that exists in that cluster has to do with intervallic relationships within every cluster, every chord structure. I don't like the construct of tonic, dominant, and subdominant. I think it's complete nonsense. And 90% of the world doesn't think 1-4-5. This is just, you know, more Western European terrorism, in my opinion. I can see musicologists all over the world hate this. But I don't believe in the supremacy of Western music. I just don't. I do not believe in the supremacy of Western music, and I am the biggest fan of Bach, Beethoven, and Ravel, and Messiaen. Yes, I understand what that is, but it's not supreme to me.
Yeah.
So for me, the thing that really guides all of my thinking, all of it, is this idea which my Brooklyn College history professor introduced me to, which is the idea that all drama comes from tension and release.
Yes.
Breathe in, breathe out. 2-3, 3-2. Conflict, resolution. So for me, there's so many more ways to express that musically than just tonic, dominant, dominant, tonic, dominant. There's so many more different ways and so many advanced harmonic tension and resolution principles that occur that have nothing to do with Western tonality and that occur on a macro and a micro level. There's just all kinds of this. I think that the vast majority of my life has been spent kind of in search of ways to communicate that same tension, release, principle, that tonic dominant, dominant tonic principle.
I mean, it's interesting, even when you hear it laid out, I reject the idea, as you say, of tonic, dominant, and subdominant, which is hierarchical. When you lay it out that way, you go, oh, this is hierarchy. And that has political implications. It has.
Whoa, does it ever? I mean, my God, it is strictly about a bunch of musicologists deciding over the span of centuries that the ultimate example of human creativity is Bach.
Yeah.
And I think Bach would have had a problem with that. And yeah. Bach would have had issues with that. He was just following his muse and his religious convictions.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
So there was a lot of the thing that we don't talk about in Bach's music, which we don't talk about in Messiaen's music either, is this idea of religious conviction, mysticism, and the idea that the thing that feeds their magic is bigger than conquering lands.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And that's what Coltrane would be talking about too, channeling some higher power, tapping into something.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I'm a person of faith. I go to church, but I don't believe in the Catholic dogma or the Episcopalian dogma. You know, I believe in the mystical realities that Messiaen shared. I mean, Les Oiseaux is not about the transfiguration. It's not about Jesus necessarily. It's about the powers of grace. Mm. It's the powers of something bigger than us that determine how that grace is played out in our lives. I'll be the last person to say, I will force you to accept my Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I'm a Jew, so it's a great place for me to go on Christmas Eve is watch you play at a church. And also, it's lovely to be in a church, and it's lovely to feel that connection. But I will say, I was a little, just knowing a little bit about who I think you are and what you're into, I was surprised when I first learned that you had a church, that you wanted to do that was you had a relationship with that church.
It's funny because if you're going to be any kind of, I hate the word Christian.
Yeah.
I hate the word Christian. Even as I say it, I hate it. It's just such a misnomer. People of faith can be people that follow Buddha. People of faith can be people that follow Moses or follow the rabbis who follow. It's a nonsensical word. And I think the first person that would agree with that is my priest.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is that, and this is honestly how I feel about it, because I also like to think of myself as kind of a quasi-Buddhist.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the dogma that attaches itself to organized religion. I believe dogma is a little bit like, here's what I really feel. I feel it's like doing scales.
Mm-hmm.
When you sit and practice, and by the way, my wife is Jewish and an atheist, and yet she's the most Christian human I've ever met in my life.
Dig it.
She's got the character of gold. I mean, she's like the highest. I've never heard her say a crossword about anybody.
Wow.
If I'm going to hold up somebody to ecumenical excellence, it's Allison.
Yeah.
She's the most beautiful person I know. And yet she doesn't believe a word of it.
Yeah.
You know, but be that
like running scales. I like that.
Yeah. Well, this is exactly what temple is, or
church or
mosque or church. It's scales. It's practicing. I practice my scales every day. Yesterday I did my scales for almost 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Double thirds. I do groups of threes and double thirds and then single note scales and forget it. It's every day. Is that what I play when I get on stage? No. Is that what I believe when I play on stage? No. Mm-hmm. It's just my fingers are not prone to being relaxed at the keyboard. My fingers are not prone to being free at the keyboard. So in order to learn freedom and articulation, I need to train them. And by the way, this could happen in your running club.
Yeah.
This could happen in your neighborhood bar.
Yeah.
That is your church.
Yeah.
Your running club is your church or your temple or your mosque.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is you're teaching yourself the freedom to love human beings. And you do that by rote. You do that by seeing your pal Carlos at the bar every Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit there and listen to each other bitch. Showing the greatest love you can show to another human being is tolerating their bitching. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with people expressing faith values.
Yes, they are.
I'm sure it has cost me in my career.
Well, I love the idea that prayer is a kind of morality scale. You know, it's like just being in touch with that language and that intention. When you go out in the world, you don't have to necessarily believe that specific story to be ready to meet somebody.
Unfortunately, a lot of people who call themselves followers of Christ are amongst the most rabid, hateful, exclusionary greed mongers that I've ever met.
Well, see the current administration.
I know one thing, they wouldn't recognize Jesus if he slapped him across the head.
Absolutely. We got sidetracked, though, which I can see can happen.
I am ADHD.
I love it. So you connect with Chico. Yeah. This is where we were. You reconnect with Chico, you get the phone call, you realize that...
Well, what happened is we did the thing, and yeah. I got the phone call, and then during the whole experiment of doing this concert with Wynton, you know, I really love Wynton. I have to say, what a lovely and brilliant and conflicted person he is, because of the position that had been handed to him from early on. And he, as I said, he was the one that had said, come join me. Because what happened is, during this whole Alice Tully Hall concert process, I remembered remarking to his assistant that, man, I really admired what Wynton had done. Lincoln Center reached out to him and gave him a vehicle for his music and the music of his people. And I remember saying to her, I'd love to talk to Wynton about, maybe he can recommend an institution that would do us the same kindness. And much to my surprise, Wynton reached out to me and said, you know, I'm going to do you one. He literally said this to me at Lincoln Square Plaza for the Christmas tree lighting. He literally said to me, I'm going to do you one better, and I'm going to invite you to be a part of the House of Swing. Mm-hmm. What a huge and generous act.
Yeah.
No one, I don't think, had ever extended to us, to our people, to my people, that no one. I mean, it always was like, hey, well, let's do a little slumming. We'll put a conga in this jazz thing, and you'll be a... Well, no, this was different. This was Wynton saying, you are indispensable to my story.
Yeah.
Please bring it.
Yeah.
And that's a different thing. That's a really different thing. Wynton and a few others have done that. Yeah. Dizzy Gillespie had done that and others. But yeah, so I brought this orchestra, created it for Wynton and jazz, and populated it with the very best musicians of that ilk. People like Mario Rivera, Bobby Purcelli, Mike Mossman, Milton Cardona. I mean, it would really, Andy was the original bass player. Uh-huh. Literally the best practitioners of this music. And over the years, I mean, it really, really evolved. My journey just began. I started examining things that most people think should not be mixed up in this music. Middle Eastern influences, of influences from Mexico, Peruvians. Yeah. It became something that I saw as a vehicle to really express my fullest belief that, as I said at the outset of this time together, this is transmigratory culture.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with nationhood. It has nothing to do with brands, marketing. It's something that has to do, and more than ever do we need this, with the essence of humanity. And that is simply this. We're not defined by nations. We're defined by common cause. And right now our common cause is to join forces against those who would destroy the planet for profit.
It seems in a way that you have spent a lot of your career and life preparing for a moment like this. I mean, it wasn't until you started writing with a purpose. You know, you start with the offense of the drum. You start to kind of make an argument for him, tell the story. This is, you know, New Orleans and El Malecón, it's the same clave that runs through them. It's the same spine that runs through that body. This most recent record, you're already talking about the environment, global warming, regardless of whether or not that is obvious when you hear the music. I mean, sometimes I think it's more obvious than other times, but the intention behind it is what's animating it. I'm asking this, we're all asking each other, what's our job right now? Can we make a difference? Does it matter what we do? Will the arts actually move the dial?
I think the arts are the only thing that will move the dial. We are journalists.
Yes.
You can just pretend that music is pretty noise, or you can think that it's only to soothe. But I don't believe that that's the purpose of art. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not castigating those people that don't feel this way. But a lot of times jazz has lost its sting. Finally, me and Cornell sitting in the dressing room of the Apollo Theater when we premiered the Cornell West Concerto, which is called Four Questions.
Yeah.
We looked at each other and went, what's going on? And almost at the exact moment we looked at each other and said, don't mean a thing if it ain't got that sting. And to me, jazz has always been about the greatest insult that has ever been perpetrated on these shores, which is that we brought a peoples from an independent sovereign land and brought them here to work for us for no pay and to be mistreated. And we will never be free in this nation until we can tell the story of slavery and genocide, of unbelievable greed. We will never be free in this nation. And I don't hate America. Yeah. I love Brooklyn. I love my block. I love where I live. I love my neighbors. I don't hate them. I don't hate this nation. I don't hate anything about the real potentiality of the people that I live with and see every day. My students, my family, my musicians, the people that came out 2 days ago and marched, 3 million of them. Yeah. That's America. Yeah. And so I think that that is impossible without truth tellers, without people saying, hey, we're a nation that was founded by illegal white males that stole an indigenous land in order to enslave those people and create a genocidal nation filled with brutality and violence throughout its history. Now, does everybody want to hear that message? No, nobody wants to hear it, just a few. But it doesn't matter, because the people that want to hear it understand that the key to our salvation is to discover the cancer within. And only in that moment can we go, oh yeah, life is beautiful. The most beautiful truth that I know of is that we die. The most beautiful truth that I know of is the people that we love die. That means that the only thing worth living for is to change the narrative. Mm. We can't change the undeniable reality of death. The most beautiful thing about it is that we have a limited time to affect the lives of the people around us. Now, other people think that the way to mitigate death is to own or to control, and that somehow by owning more buildings and ships and planes or by controlling more people, somehow they're extending the reality of their life and they're denying the reality of their death. And I think those are the people that are dead.
Not to be trusted anyway.
Well, those are the people who are living the least.
Yeah.
The people that are living, man, the people that are living their fullest lives are the people who know, hey, this moment is a gift to be given away. And this is the greatest thing my friend Tom Cambridge taught me about this book, The Gift. The gift cannot be kept. It's not a gift if you keep it. It's only a gift if you give it away.
Yes.
And the only thing that keeps us alive is to keep giving this gift to one another.
Mm.
That is eternal life. Forget about the church.
Yeah.
The eternal life is giving the gift away.
Well, one of the things you just said is it is to affect the way other people think. And to me, like, that's, having grown up secular Jewish, that's a very Jewish idea to me.
Oh, yeah. It's rabbinical.
You said something earlier apropos of this mortality question, which was, you know, your biggest fear was to be compared to your father, and your other biggest fear was that he was going to die. We're all afraid we're going to die. The people we love in our lives are going to die. Did your father's frailty, and ultimately when he passed, was that part of what helped you to finally step forward and assert yourself more fully?
I think you just asked an incredibly beautiful question, one that's never been asked of me. And if I look back upon the moments leading up to his death, I realize that he himself detached from the meaninglessness of living for existence sake. As he got older and as he got more frail, he started becoming mellower and kinder and more beautiful. And it got to the point where he just didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And that was the point that I remember him being at his most openness and kindest. And I think that in that sense, the tyranny, there's a wonderful word that I've, is part of Christian dogma. There's a title of a book. The tyranny of the urgent is such a mitigator for so many of us. The truth is that nothing matters more than what you give to others. And my father, in his dying days, gave me permission to reassess who I was in a very real way.
Yeah.
He just, by just going, I'm just, you know, he knew what was happening. He knew he had lost the ability.
And you were running essentially his band at that
point. I was running his band and watching. Listen, there was nothing scarier to me than playing on Summer Stage with Chico and Patato and Cachao.
Yeah.
And Chico was so physically compromised that he was defying gravity. He literally walked at an angle to the earth. I was just waiting for him to go ahead and fall over. And then playing Birdland with him and looking out, he could barely... My father was, and I shouldn't probably share this, but I will anyway. My father was so physically compromised that he was at home in a wheelchair, you know, begging me to come back to Birdland. And I just remember the last few years of Birdland, looking at him, looking out at the sea of cigarette smoke, because in those days, any club was looking out and seeing a haze.
Yeah.
And thinking about my father having trouble breathing, having trouble digesting, and having trouble, and thinking, this is, that's not worth it. Not just, not good for him, not worth it.
Yeah.
At one point, my father let go of that. And maybe he had to, maybe he didn't have to, but at one point he went, damn it, I'm not so important. That was beautiful. And that was something that I think one spends, and it's amazing to me that we began this talk by talking about the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Because I think that the thing that the imposter syndrome shows us is that it's a construct to help us understand that, yeah, we don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the things that I try to do when I compose is divorce myself from the creatures that I'm giving birth to, because I don't matter. These things called notes want to find their way.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I can do is impose dictatorial order on them or get out of the way. I don't matter. And the older I get, the more I get like, wow, this is incredibly liberating, to this idea that, yeah, but wow, hanging on to stuff is really, really counterproductive.
I think it's so deep, this conversation, because like when I listen to your writing, you have a masterful command of what your band can do. You know how to make it do a lot of things and evoke a lot of sounds and emotion. And there's so much technique in that. And there's so much knowledge and study and information and diligence. It's not all chaos. And I mean, I know that your organizing principles, the thing that's motivating you and animating you, is much bigger than trying to put a category around things. I feel that from you over and over again. And yet there's a whole technical aspect that you're doing that isn't just letting anything happen, letting the notes find each other. I mean, I understand that that's philosophically what's happening, but you're also, you know, you're an educator. You're somebody who has, I imagine, very strong aesthetic beliefs and feelings about what is and isn't right, or what, to you anyway, what you want it to be.
It's funny. I feel like I know my musicians very well. So I write for them specifically. And I know that if, you know, at one point I studied orchestration with David Del Tredici.
Yeah.
And at one point I passed all my exams and got degrees. And I don't know that any of that really plays into
what
I sit down to write. When I sit down to write, I think about it's funny we're talking about this, because it just literally finished, as I said, a piece for this. And this leads me to a whole thing that I will talk about in a minute. But at the end of the process of the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra and all that we've done in the years and years after we were ejected from the House of Swing, I created...
I didn't realize you were ejected.
Well, I would call it ejection. It was a financial decision. Uh-huh. I think Winton understood that they could not support two orchestras. And I asked him, I said, is it something we did? Is it, you know, Winton was quite generous in art parting. He said, no, you guys brought honor to this, and it's you rocked the house, but we don't have a business strategy for you. Winton was very honest and clear with me when we left. But it was an ejection nonetheless, because they did not also create the support structure for us.
Yeah.
They also didn't invest in the infrastructure for the band. So, and I don't think he was responsible for that at all. I think it's just institutional dynamics.
Yeah.
I've lived at the top of institutional dynamics. I was an associate dean at UCLA.
Yeah.
I know what administration is like. Yeah. So they just did not support the thing institutionally. He did, but they didn't. I don't know if that's fair to say, if this will come back to haunt me, but nonetheless, that association with Jazz Lincoln Center, which, by the way, I also really love. I think what Jazz Lincoln Center does is important. And that association with Winton credentialized me to be able to do what I did after I was ejected. We created a nonprofit called the Afro-Latin Jazz Alliance, and I literally taped music parts on my kitchen table with my wife and bought water and cookies for rehearsals. And we put on a 6-concert season at Symphony Space and found a school in Canarsie to teach, and created a nonprofit at 501c3 in Delaware, and had a, you know, beginning board of directors, and every year it grew and grew and grew and grew. And one year we found ourselves with a real executive director, and the next year with a real board of directors, and the third year with a big budget, and the fourth year with residencies, and it grew and grew and grew and grew to the point where, and this is a source of amazement, if you think my imposter syndrome is in full blown fury when I compose or play, this is where I have to go. I've embraced it fully, because I don't know how this happened, but this organization that grew and grew and grew became a monster. We changed the dialogue. We changed the conversation about what this music is. We created educational residencies, pre-professional training program. We have over 40 teaching artists in 21 New York City public schools. We have a pre-professional training program. We have a collection. We have
a space.
Well, now we were invited to create a performing space, a culture hub in Harlem, in an affordable housing project that's being built starting in June of 2025, or maybe in January of 26. Ground will be broken on a 19-story affordable housing building called Timbali Terrace. And the first two floors of that building will be Casa Belongo, the Afro-Latin Jazz Alliance Community Culture Hub, which will have a community gathering space, a community cafe, a jazz club, practice rooms, rehearsal rooms, and a 350-seat state-of-the-art theater. All of this is like beyond anything I could have imagined my life leading to. The city of New York has committed $21 million dollars to it. We've gotten grants from incredible benefactors, the city, the Mellon, the Ford. But the thing is that we've done the work. That's the thing that everybody understands, is for years we didn't just talk. We walked the walk and did the work of going into schools and challenging art and creating structures where people can have intercourse of ideas. Yeah. But we were lucky enough to end up working with one of the premier architectural firms in the world, an organization called DSR Diller, Scafidio and Renfro, which has designed the Shed, the High Line, Alice Tully Hall, the Juilliard School. This is an incredible, incredible architectural firm that has done international, like somehow this is who we ended up working with. And the founding partner of this firm was a man named Ricardo Scafidio, who's one of the first MacArthur recipients in architecture. And he was a musician. He was a bass player. We met Ricardo Scafidio on a regular basis during our design drawing meetings. This man just passed a month or so ago. It was a big deal. It was a New York Times obit. But more than that, man, the people at DSR told me that one of his great prides was realizing that this was one of the last projects he worked on, was designing Casa Belongo. And so I've spent the last 3 days composing a piece in the memory of Ricardo Scafidio called simply The Architect. And all I can say is I brought to this the same thing I brought to Mundo Agua, the Afro-Latin Jazz Suite, the Four Questions, the same aesthetic. I don't know what I'm doing. I have no clue how it works, but I have this firm idea that the design process comes to you. I think about what it means to be an architect, what it means to sit and, very much like a composer, draw these things that later on become structures, and how you start with a foundation, how you start with what the thing will be supported by, and how that thing will support the upper structures, and what that upper structures will do, and how you decorate them. And so I don't know if it's a good piece or not, but I have followed the dictates of what I've been doing for many, many years. And I created an original work that I really hope does honor and justice to this, quite frankly, this giant of a man.
And do you have a sense of when you'll perform it?
We'll perform it next week.
You're going to do it next at Carnegie Hall on Friday.
Carnegie Hall on Friday.
Four days from right now.
As soon as I finished composing, I thought, this piece is awful. My career is over.
So, okay, given all that, how do you teach? I mean, how do you approach teaching, and what are the values that you try to impart when you teach?
I am as big a fraud in teaching as I am in composing. I have the books and the textbooks, and I write these very exhausting syllabi, and I do these incredibly exhausting lesson plans, and I get in front of a group of people, and I kind of realize that they're not going to look at my syllabus, they're not going to look at my lesson plans, and that they want something that it's called playing the room.
Mm.
And what I do is I look at them, and I try to figure out what I can do to get them to understand their journey. I find that 90% of the students I teach can read about writing drop five for saxophones, mm-hmm. or they can see it on YouTube. You can literally learn anything you want about music on YouTube.
That's not
the purpose of my presence in front of them. The purpose I have in front of them is the purpose that my other mentor, the other biggest mentor in my life, which I should tell you about, is a gentleman by the name of Teófilo Ruiz.
Mm.
Teófilo Ruiz was an American history teacher in the CUNY system at Brooklyn College, where I received my undergraduate degree. Mm. And Teófilo Ruiz, who ended up, by the way, being on my recommendation panel for my distinguished professorship at UCLA. Somehow he ended up there. Anyway, Teófilo Ruiz is the person who said, don't believe anything you read. Don't listen to anything I say. And then he blew my brains apart. He looked at me and he said, why are you a musician? What? Nobody had ever asked me that before. Why are you a musician?
He said,
to what end? Sex, drugs, rock and roll? What is the thing you, what do you expect to get out of this? And then he said to me, and you have the ability to write and speak and communicate.
Yes.
What are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
And if it weren't for Teófilo Ruiz and Chico Farrell and Carla Bley and other people in my life, I would not be building Casa Bilongo because the whole point of writing notes is not just to write notes. And in fact, if you do it right, the music disappears and what's left is the humanity that you bring together.
Yeah.
So what I do is I read the room. I look at students and I realize this one's really not interested.
Hmm.
They just want to get the grade. This one is having an existential crisis and wants to figure out why composing is so central to his identity or their identity.
Yeah.
That one is actually like bristling with talent but has no aesthetic.
Yeah.
And I look at them and I kind of go, that this one, that, this one, this, that's one, that. And then I look at them and I kind of really try and figure out what can I do? And this is basically what I feel like I do. What can I do to give them permission?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the role of the educator is to give a young mind the permission to fulfill its greatest potential.
Yeah.
Most students have been taught, follow this rule, read that axiom, finish that book, file this report, and you'll be complete. And that's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that all of that can be, anything you want to learn now, you can learn on YouTube. The only thing that you cannot learn from YouTube is how to be given assent,
mm-hmm.
how to be given permission, how to be inspired, how to be mentored into feeling, and I know this sounds crazy coming from someone who says they're an imposter, but how to be given permission to express, and this is the essence of everything, how to express your deepest self without remorse, how to express your sovereignty and agency and take pride in who you are, how you identify, and how you will communicate that identity to the world.
Yes.
That is the biggest challenge of teaching, is how to construct a positive scenario so that a young human being can be given permission to move forward in life. That's what we want to do. We don't want to, I mean, we can give information, and frequently I do, and sometimes it's erroneous and sometimes it's correct. But the best thing I can do, you ask me what I teach and how I teach, it comes from Teófilo Ruiz, who said to me, why the hell are you?
Yeah.
And that was the first time anybody said to me, why the hell are you? And he forced me and forced me and forced me to think about what I do and how I do it and why I do it. So thank God for Teofilo Reis.
You also had a longstanding gig as the music director for
Harry Belafonte.
Harry Belafonte.
Yes, of course.
That's another example of an artist who had a much deeper sense of purpose in the work that he was doing, and he was an activist.
Harry was a real hero. Harry inspired me on so many different levels. I had never met someone who was so passionate about world music. His musicians were from Trinidad, South Africa, Brazil. I mean, I had never met someone who spoke so eloquently. The thing about Harry is that he was deeply, deeply inspiring. He could literally read the ingredients from a box of cereal and it would inspire you. No, Harry, and of course I had the relationship of him as being an employee, so there was that part of it. But I caught his magic, and I caught the idea that for Harry, all of this was a game. For Harry, the music, all of it was a way to get to another end. And that's the thing that I left Harry with. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, it's funny because Mr. B, as we call him, was actually quite, from what I had heard, was quite infirm and couldn't see, couldn't speak. And I actually got to speak with him in the last few months of his life. Steve Jones got him on the phone and true to his nature, I got on the phone and I was beside myself. I said, Harry, I just want you to know that, you know, you're the first person I met who had a global view of music. You're the first person I met who really inspired me to think beyond. And he literally said in that famous, famous way, he said, I bet you say that to all the girls. Harry was one of the most important heroes in American culture for so many reasons. Not only was he one of the first black men to reach that level of stardom, he was also there by the side of Martin Luther King during those marches. Yes. He stood up at a time when doing this as a white person would destroy your career, let alone doing this as a black man. Harry was a good singer.
Yeah.
Incredible artist. But his real stature was as a defender of humanity and as a civil rights hero. And I mean, can you imagine being next to Martin Luther King? And just so many things about him the way that he dealt with life was very straightforward. And I just think that you need to have that when you're a person of conscience. Mm-hmm. You need to understand how to play the game and how to be really clear with human beings.
I know what a deep thinker you are and how serious you are about what you're doing. And I can tell also that humor and joy and lightness, levity is part of what's going on with you also. And I guess that's where I want to land, in the sense that, like, you got a lot of weight on your shoulders. And at the same time, I think we have to enjoy ourselves. And, you know, you make music that is, even if it's not always commercial, feels good to listen to. I think the experience of being around you is a very enjoyable thing too. How do you find lightness in all this, and humor and levity?
I think I laugh a lot. My father used to crack up. They used to think, we used to see, he would laugh, and my wife is like this.
Yeah.
They would laugh so profoundly that their face, my father's, would get contorted. And it quite frankly, it looked like he was in incredible pain, that he was about to die.
Yeah.
And my sister and I used to call this the risa negra, which is literally Spanish for the black laugh.
Yeah.
And we got so much joy out of causing this laughter in him. We would try to give him la risa negra all the time.
Yeah.
And my wife is prone to having these fits of such deep laughter that her face contorts and you think she's going to die. It's not a death wish. I don't wish death on her or on my father.
Yeah.
But the idea that you can cause this much joy in somebody else is deeply riveting to me. Without a doubt, one of my spiritual fathers is Mel Brooks.
Yes, my
Springtime for Hitler.
Yes.
Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
The Marx Brothers.
Yes.
Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
To me, Bananas, Woody Allen. I know that's not politically correct, but from my perspective, Bananas, Manhattan, these are formative statements about the existential foolishness of hanging on to that which we can't hang on to.
Yeah.
My mentor, Teofilo Ruiz, spoke about the existential crisis of realizing that life is, we're dead in 70 years.
Yeah.
What a glorious and incredible joke that is.
Yes.
And so I find that seriousness is overrated.
Yeah.
And that at the end of the day, the joke's on the world. Because we out of here.
Yeah.
We out of here, and all the bullshit that's going on here, we leave it behind.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what happens. I don't expect much.
Yeah.
But I know that laughing while you're here and giving other people the ability to have risa negra is the greatest calling a human being can have. I may not have been born Jewish, but I'm about as Jewish as you can get. Yes. My Yiddishkeit is on a level that you wouldn't believe. I mean, I don't feel, I am so culturally Jewish that whatever birth blood I have, it just doesn't matter. But I feel that there is a thing where we think of Jewish as this cartoonishness that I think is so wrong.
Yeah.
I think modernism.
Yes.
And it's so important to get away from the shtetl Hasidic kind of view of Judaism and look at geniuses like Mel Brooks and the contemporary reality of having this incredible wealth of experience and knowledge that the learned Jewish thinkers of our time who give us everything.
Yes.
One of the reasons I identify as a Jew without having that birthright is humor. Yeah. Humor, the writings of great Jewish authors. I mean, everything that I know culturally comes from Africa and New York Judaism.
Yes.
But I think that very often when you
I see what you're saying.
When you program Jewish music, people expect that.
Yes.
And I think that belittles the powerful identity of a Paul Shapiro or a Frank London or a...
Sure.
Now, these are people whose identities are so fluid.
I mean, yes, we could... argue that, or an Irving Berlin or a George Gershwin too. I mean, we don't consider that Jewish music, but you know, there's a lot of
It's informed by a Jewish aesthetic.
Yes.
Which I think is more important than the definition of Judaism.
Yes.
The definition of Judaism is so varied. It's a culture, it's a tradition, it's a religion, it's a birth. Blah, 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 blah. You know, the oldest question in the world is, what is a Jew? That next oldest question is, what is jazz? Either way, you're not going to define it.
Yeah.
Either way, the beautiful thing about it is its indefinability.
Yes.
It's, if that's a word that I can coin.
Ineffability, maybe.
Yeah, maybe ineffability. Yeah. But defining sometimes defining things kills them.
Yeah.
And I think that in this case, the it's funny, my son lives in Bed-Stuy.
Yeah.
Nothing is more interesting to me than coming home, driving him home from a gig and seeing, you know, the Lubavitch wandering around and just the beauty of that culture. And is it a culture I understand? No. Is it a culture I identify with? No. But it's incredible to me, the tenacity and power and grace of people who define themselves.
Yes.
And this is one of the things that I think also we typically associate with the Jewish struggle, with the African-American struggle. And I think that, yes, being an outsider causes great character building. I can vouch for that. Not being Jewish, not being black, not being Latino, not being white.
Well, whatever you are, Arturo O'Farrell, thank you for spending this time with me today,
just
man.
Just that name alone. Yeah.
That tells you everything.
O'Farrell. I remember somebody sending me a clip from a show we did in London with Carla Bley. And the reviewer said, Arturo O'Farrell. A stage name, if ever I've heard one.
But it's real.
It's real. And it's been real sitting with you. It's been a privilege.
For me as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.